Yo, 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 everybody. This is Greg Knox, and these are the worst date movies ever. I am joined on this episode by Tom Dennett Cook once again.
Hello, thanks for having me back.
That's all right, mate. And if you haven't done so already, however you're listening to this podcast, please subscribe, and then you'll receive all our future episodes, and your life will be that much better for that. Right, so the film we're talking about today, you can't really spoil it as such, I don't think.
Good luck trying to spoil it.
Yeah, it's not really that kind of film, and it's also not really offensive as such, unless you're probably like a hardcore Christian type.
Yeah.
Maybe. But in case you are really, really, really offended by Christian satire and that kind of thing, and yeah, just be aware there may be discussion of a religious nature, and there may be spoilers, I guess. But
I guess. I mean, I could tell you what happens in it, but I don't think it would spoil it.
Yes. So the film we are discussing in a roundabout way is The Holy Mountain, or to give it its Spanish title, La Montaña Sagrada, which is, now this is quite interesting, it's directed by Alejandro Jodorowsky, who is the director of El Topo and Santa Sangre and various more recent films as well. But not only did he direct it and write it and produce it, he also did some of the music, some of the set design, some of the costumes, and he was in the film as the alchemist.
Very busy.
So this is a proper, like, auteurist project.
Yeah, this is him, 100%.
Definitely, 100% him. Tom, I'm going to give you the honour of somehow trying to summarise, as best you can, what the actual fuck happens in this film.
Okay, without getting into any of the crazy shit. Oh, Greg, thanks for trying to make me explain this. I think it's just about going on a spiritual journey. And you have all these different characters, and they each represent something about, I guess, non-spiritual society. So there's the capitalist and the policeman, and all these other people. They all go together on a spiritual journey. And basically, to me, it's a kind of fucking blitzkrieg of spiritualism. They throw everything in for these people to try. There's a lot of insane, surreal imagery. But in a nutshell, it's just about people going on a spiritual quest, the ultimate goal of which is to conquer the Holy Mountain, because quite a lot of different religious traditions have a Holy Mountain that you conquer. They're taken on this quest by a wise master, an alchemist. And then, in a nutshell, they kind of... I mean, I don't know if you want me to say what I think the moral of the story is, but that's basically what I think the story is.
Okay. Yeah, because that kind of... sort of, because this film... I kind of posed this question at the start, and obviously I'm going to get back to this some point near the end.
Mm-hmm.
But with a film like this, is it basically, I mean, we know people, I'm not going to mention any names.
But we know people.
We know people who, they're all about the story, and the story has to make sense.
Yeah.
And it's all about kind of like, okay, everything has to make sense and everything has to follow a certain
pattern. Traditional Western linear...
linear story of telling, yes. This is very much not like that in the fucking slightest.
In a weird way, it kind of is. I mean, it doesn't, for example, start at the end and go back to the beginning, or start halfway through and then have flashbacks.
Flapjacks
either. Yeah. It has everything but flapjacks. But I would say that there is a central character, the kind of Jesus character, and you see his journey from essentially start to finish, and he meets people on the way, and he goes on a journey. So it has a linear story. It's just a lot of shit happens very quickly all the time that doesn't go well together. And that's what I think would confuse somebody who wants a traditional linear story.
Yeah. So this is the thing with surrealism, is that... yeah, you just kind of have to just take it for what it is, really, and just accept it in its own internal logic.
Yes.
I guess. And it's the same with Lynch, although Lynch's films are a bit more rooted in the real world.
Lynch has a kind of more of a sort of, yes, it is surreal, but it's more like, because it's set in mundane, in the real life world or mundane settings, that's what makes it difficult to swallow. Whereas Jodorowsky tends to favour the other end of the scale, which is, I'm going to be like hyper surreal. I'm going to have lots of contrasting colours and symbolism. And whereas Lynch is more like, it's more like subconscious what Lynch does.
Yeah. I'd say Lynch is more dreamlike. This is, I mean, I've written in my notes mm-hmm. for this. This is basically death by symbolism.
Yes.
Because literally, if we went through every single thing in the film that could be a symbol for something else, I think we'd be here for hours.
Yeah, this is like a sort of Sinbad film, but directed by Salvador Dali.
Fucking hell. Yeah, I guess that is a good way of putting it.
And I know it's a cliche to use Salvador Dali, but it really is a sort of surrealism turned up to 11 mixed with mysticism just for the sake of it, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, basically how it works from a storytelling structure is, mm-hmm. is basically there are three acts. So
yes, definitely.
There's three sections. They're very distinct sections as well. So your first section revolves around a character who in the credits is called the Thief, mm-hmm. but is basically Jesus.
Yes.
And then the second section is him meeting the alchemist. And then the sort of, it's like a, almost like an anthology film type structure mm-hmm. from then on. It's like a tableau. I don't know if that's the right word to use, where you've got all these sort of eight other characters and they've got short stories kind of introducing yeah. them. And then they go on this spiritual quest where yeah. it's like they need to reach enlightenment.
That's what I mean. It's a very traditional yeah. linear story. There is a central character, the hero, as it were. He then puts together a fellowship of sorts, and then they conquer a mountain. It's basic stuff when you stop and think
like
about
Lord
it.
Of the Rings,
yeah, it's
guys.
Basically Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a hobbit that steals a ring. Yeah, I guess you I know. Guess, there's yeah. a fellowship. There's a mountain. Done.
Yeah, there's short people in it.
Sure, there's a lot. Yeah, yeah. There's everyone.
Yeah, so one of Hodorowsky's trademarks is people with no limbs.
Yeah, I mean, this is something you could talk all day about. He definitely uses amputees and deformities as symbols for God knows what they symbolize half the time, but but he is very fond of using them.
Mm. Yeah, so I really, really like this film. It's, as far as surreal films go, I think this is definitely kind of one of my favorites. And for this show, kind of what I did was obviously for this show, basically what we do is we watch the film and then we literally talk about it straight afterwards. Yep. But what I had to do for a film like this is, because it's frankly so fucking weird, there's about a million things going on in it, I had to kind of watch it before mm-hmm. as well. And watching it a second time in such a short space of time, it makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
Of sorts. I mean, it ain't going to make... I got to be honest, this whole... Anything to do with, like, metaphors and symbolism and this means this and blah, blah, blah. I'm not very good at things like that. I'm just going to come out and say it straight away. So a lot of the meanings are going to be lost on me. But there's definitely... I mean, just look at the imagery. I mean, the imagery is so awesome that you kind of just get swept up in it, particularly in the middle section with the alchemist.
I would say that a lot of stuff happens. I've seen this film quite a few times.
Right. Okay.
And I do think that
it's like your Cannibal Holocaust.
Yeah, I mean, like, the first time you watch it, you're just like, wow, this is batshit crazy. But the more you watch it, the more you're like, well, okay, that is pretty straightforward. He sees the alchemist, he turns his shit into gold. That's a pretty straightforward metaphor. Okay, he's Jesus, and then he's Jesus. He wakes up in a room full of all these fake Jesuses, and he gets angry and smashes him. That's a sort of almost a reaction towards the commercialization of religion. All the metaphors, when you stop and view them individually, are really straightforward.
Yeah.
But it's just because there's so much of it, it's almost like a super film. There's so much going on. And if you were to give each thing its fair dues, it would probably be like an 8-hour film, but it isn't. It's everything condensed into short. So my problem watching it normally is you don't have time to process what you've just seen
yeah.
before you're four metaphors down the road. And it happens. Yeah. Everything happens so quickly that you know. And sometimes I think I think he's almost like trolling. Okay. I don't know if this existed back
it's
then.
Like, no way.
I think, yeah, I think this is almost like surrealist trolling. I think he knows he's doing way too much. And I'm willing to bet some of the metaphors don't mean anything. And he just put them in there just for fucking sake of it.
It's always possible. Yeah. Because, frankly, like you said, there's so many of them. So I'm mm-hmm. sure, I mean, have you seen Hodorowsky's Dune, like the documentary?
I have not.
Or have you heard him speak?
I have heard him speak about it, and I know people have seen the documentary.
Because he's a fascinating guy.
He's like, really intelligent.
He's
and
like,
he's massively into tarots and all kinds of things.
He's on a completely different level from like the majority of people. So all this stuff really makes so much sense to him.
Mm-hmm.
Even little things, like there'll be a quick flashing image which lasts like half a second, which appears to seemingly have no meaning, that he'll be like, oh, well, actually, blah, 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 blah.
That means this.
But yeah, and no, I absolutely love it. I just love the way it looks. And just what I like about it, because it is very, very surreal. Mm-hmm. And what I would say to people who don't necessarily like surreal films, I probably recommend this one in a way, because there's so much going on, you can't really get bored.
Yeah.
It's kind of what I'd say.
I had this on once in the background with the sound off, whilst we had people over, and we were just playing board games, and I just wanted something on in the background. Nobody could concentrate on the game at all, because not a second passes where the screen is not like exploding with metaphors, actors, all kinds of things. So it is a good sort of introduction. I personally prefer his El Tupo that came before.
Right.
Because I think this film, I love this film, but it's like an all-you-can-eat banquet. There comes a point where you're just exhausted. Whereas El Tupo has a nice balance in acts, and sometimes there's quite a bit, and sometimes this is just, as I said before, after the success of El Tupo, he was basically given a blank check to do whatever he wanted. And this is what happens when Jodorowsky can do whatever he wants with no creative or financial restraints. And I don't think he made another film straight away.
No.
I think nobody would touch him after this. They were like, no, you're way too crazy for us. The world's not ready for you.
Yeah, he tried to do June, I think, after this. And, you know, he had all these... For anyone who hasn't seen the documentary, it's great. I really do recommend it. But essentially, it boils down to he had all these crazy ideas, which probably would have been absolutely awesome, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a shame that the film never happened the way it did. But then
remakes are always possible now.
Well, yeah, exactly. And then he went to all these different studios and said, do you want to finance my film? And like, well, it looks awesome, but nah.
But no fucking way. Not with you.
No. Which of the three sections did... I'm asking which one's your favourite is probably a bit reductivist, but it's like, which one do you get the most out of? Because it's hard to talk about this in terms of like a narrative structure, like a normal film. So you almost have to pick like your personal highlights for whatever reason.
I would say the third part. The first part is almost is really the bit where there's just loads of weird shit happening, almost for its own sake, and it's very busy. So that's fun to watch. That's a real feast for the eyes. But it's not my favourite. The second bit is mainly where you're again introduced to each character and they have all their little mini stories. That's quite good and that's quite straightforward. You get, okay, so the toy person doesn't want to do their job anymore because they're, you know, why they don't want to do it. The policeman's got sick of all of the things. It's very self-explanatory, all those individual characters. The real quest as such, which is what the driving force of the film is really about, it's about a spiritual quest, that all happens in the final third bit. I said just before we started, my favourite scene is in that final bit, which is the Pantheon Bar, which is a perfectly shot section, perfect metaphor for so many people. Greg, you must have bumped into these sorts of people who think that they're really spiritually deep, but really they haven't gone beyond a very limited level of spiritualism.
They think if they have a
couple of tattoos and take some pills, they think that makes them a Buddhist or something. And the Pantheon Bar is just full of all these people who haven't quite made the journey. There's a very obvious Timothy Leary character that always makes me chuckle. The guy who's taken all the drugs and he's like, the Book of the Dead is a trip and the apocalypse is like a mushroom and the crucifix is... He's hilarious. That guy who runs horizontally through the mountain and thinks that because he's won, sort of, that means he's conquered the mountain. The poetry guy who just basically is talking shit. He's talking shit. And you're just... It's so beautiful. That whole scene, in a way, makes up for any... Up until that point, you might be saying, this film's really pretentious. It's just weird shit for the sake of it. And then you watch that scene, and that scene is almost making fun of anything you thought prior to that in terms of things being... It's like, I understand what you're saying about some people are just talking...
Gibberish
when it comes to spiritualism.
Nonsense.
And that's what this scene is all about. It's all about like a wink to that.
Yeah, because from what I read up very briefly, kind of before we recorded this, I think El Topo came out, made lots of money.
Yeah.
There were people who, because of the movement that Hodorowsky was involved with at the time, there were people who just saw it as kind of like, well, this is not counterculture. This is in some way kind of hypocritical in some way. So I think there are bits in The Holy Mountain that are kind of deliberately poking fun at that. Like
yes.
that section, or like the section that is one of the little stories about one of the other characters.
Mm-hmm.
The one is the second one where you're talking about how, oh, we need to arm people, and it's all the different weapons. So you've got the guitar,
a countercultural.
Gun.
Yeah, the students need something during their sit-ins
yeah,
and protests.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that kind of stuff is deliberately meant to be satirical. Yeah,
a cynicism about the countercultural movement and how it hasn't. A bit like something Hunter S. Thompson would do.
Yeah.
A cynicism about how counterculture hasn't really achieved its goals and has just stagnated a bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard for me to pick kind of which sections I kind of like the most. I agree with you about the first section. The first section is almost like, you know, is overwhelming.
Yeah.
The first 25 minutes, that whole section, it's just literally one thing after another. And it's just almost too much to take in.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got, yeah, this Jesus figure, and he's covered with flies, and then he's being crucified, and then he's not being crucified, and then there's this, you know, short person with, you know, one arm and no legs or whatever.
Yeah.
And then there's all these soldiers everywhere, and then...
We said that's in the first 2 minutes. I turned around here and went, this has been 2 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, there's certain images that I liked. I did like the section with the toads and the chameleon
that
sort
is
of
so
war section.
Absurd. It's so brilliant, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. Which is just, how did he dress up all those chameleons? Like, that's impossible.
There's so many scenes. Well, like, there was that scene with the testicles and the glasses, and you're like, somebody had to set that up for one shot.
Yeah, exactly. It's just so much of the production design, it's just so ornate. It's in that, yeah, you're right. It's like someone had to literally hand put all that stuff together.
Yeah.
And like, just for what? Like a 30-second section of the film. It's like, right, pull all this away now. We're finishing
right,
this.
Now bring on the toads. We're ready for the next bit.
Yeah. And there's the old guy who takes his eye out because it's a glass eye. And I'm thinking like, what the fuck is this? And like,
you know what? It's only now we're talking about it. Having just watched it, that obviously we literally have just started talking about it as it's ended, and the final scene is brilliant in that film, because he basically breaks the film down, and he kind of goes, the alchemist is like, you know, we started off basically in fantasy or in a dream world, we then entered reality, but reality is itself not real, and then the camera pans away, spoiler alert. But basically that kind of makes sense when you watch the film. As you say, the first third is
just,
what did you say?
It's phantasmagorical. It's
phantasmagorical.
Just overwhelming.
Overwhelming.
Just
that was
symbolism.
Weird. You said the first third is overwhelming. And he kind of says that at the end. He's kind of like, yeah, the first bit is, you know, it's a dream. It's, and then you go, oh yeah. He's basically telling you how he's made the film at the end.
Yeah. I like the middle section as well a lot. Mm-hmm. Just the whole section of the thief kind of approaching the alchemist in these rainbow colored kind of hallway with a fucking camel. And this dude on the throne with like two goats behind him.
Two goats, woman covered in tattoos.
Yeah, just like practically naked. And yeah, it's just, I just love how that looks. And Hodorowsky, I need to rewatch his other films because I haven't watched them for a very long time, if I'm being honest. I don't know if this is a thing of his, but I've noticed in this film, anyway, there are a lot of really cool symmetrical shots.
Yeah.
So particularly from overhead. So particularly in those sections, there's a scene of, so they're washing the thief in this ornate white bath with a hippo in the bath and all these white tiles on the wall. And it's just perfectly symmetrical. And then the next scene, it's also shot from above, this blue room. And it's again, perfectly symmetrical. Or there's a dinner scene in one of the shorter stories where, again, the dinner table is like ridiculously symmetrical. And it's like all these people at this table. And just things like that, where you don't really get those kind of shots anymore, because you can do most of it, I suppose, in CGI. This is like practical effects to like a ridiculous degree.
I think these are very unique to this film. Like my memory of his other films are that those kind of shots are very unique to this film. It's like everyone is living in a symbol of some kind. Every table and every chair is a symbol of some kind.
And like you said, like the main character, well, Hodorowski's character is an alchemist. Mm-hmm. And I suppose there must be a lot of alchemical, if that's even a word, sort of symbolism in there as well.
Well, I don't know if it's the DVD, if it's this DVD that comes with the documentary, but I did watch one documentary where he's basically talking about, within the context of this film, about tarot cards and alchemy.
Yeah, it is this one, yeah.
And the way he explains it, it doesn't make the film make any more sense, but it kind of, you understand why he's gone down that road, because he's not just, you know, I said earlier, it was kind of like, is he just taking the piss sometimes? Mm. Is he trolling? It's kind of like, well, I think he might be to a degree, but not as much as I initially thought before I watched that documentary. I was like, oh, he really is into this kind of stuff. He's really deep into this, you know.
Yeah, I got to be honest, I did start watching the tarot card documentary. It did lose me after a couple
yeah,
of
he does go really deep into it.
I'm like, yeah, this is way above me. Sorry, I'm a mere mortal. The first time I saw the film recently, I didn't like these middle sections with all the different characters. Yeah. They felt very short and kind of like insignificant.
It stops the flow of the film. It damns the film.
It kind of does. But this time around when I watched it, I kind of got a lot more of what he's trying to do. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it is very satirical in one way or another. It almost reminded me, I don't know if you agree with this or not, but a lot of it was very Brass Eye-esque. So like the woman who's like talking about, wanting to collaborate with the government to invade Peru.
Yeah. Told you that's my favorite mini story. Yeah,
like that kind of thing. Or the section in the art gallery with like all the ridiculous art, like,
the art factory.
We're
gonna manufacture some art today.
Which
I'm guessing is poking fun at Andy Warhol's factory,
probably. Wouldn't surprise me. But yeah, you've got, obviously, I mean, if you've seen the trailer for this film, which again doesn't really spoil the film because it's kind of impossible to spoil in trailer form. It's like, here's a bunch of imagery. It's like it's fucking awesome. But like the people putting paint on their asses and then sitting on canvases, or the sex machine thing.
Sex machine.
Whatever that is. Just all felt very, very kind of Chris Morris.
It did feel very tongue-in-cheek. Mm. Yeah, that's what I'm saying when I say, like, I feel like the film's almost taking the piss or trolling. It definitely has a sense of humour about it.
Yeah.
About itself and that,
Yeah. And it's just, they all kind of have their own kind of unique look as well, to kind of distinguish themselves from each other. So it's not literally the same thing eight times.
And also that middle sequence is probably the most straightforward and least surreal, because you basically go, okay, this guy is a policeman and this is why he doesn't like his job. This guy is the finance minister and this is why he doesn't like his life. This person makes toys and basically is training kids to kill.
Peruvians. Yeah.
And so you kind of go, okay, I get why each one of these people doesn't want to be themselves anymore. They want to go and change their lives. I get that, you know. So it's the most straightforward part of the film in its satire.
Well, they're all linked to planets. And apparently, like, each one of their characters has the worst aspects of people who are born under that planet sign or whatever. I don't know.
That makes sense. Within that's the context of him and tarot cards and alchemy, he's going to know all that kind of stuff, isn't he?
Yeah. So that one, again, I kind of like that section for those reasons. And then the third set part of the film is kind of the most straightforward, because you're not jumping around different things. It's a lot more kind of straightforward because you're only following the same 10 characters. And it's about the spiritual awakening. It's a lot of stuff that I've seen in documentaries or TV shows where people go to these tribes and they have to drink like a green liquid that makes them trip and that kind of thing. So it just reminded me of that. And then they go to the bar.
Pantheon bar
that you said. And then they all start seeing really, really fucked up sort of stuff, like literally in the last 10 minutes of the film.
Yeah, on the way to the mountain, they're told you will hallucinate things, ignore them or something.
Yeah, and some of them, I'm just like, what the actual fuck is this?
There is one moment where I was just like, I'm always like, you've got to be taking the piss. And that's the old man with the, what was it, like tiger heads for tits?
Yeah, tiger heads for breasts, and he had different hair lengths on one half of his face.
And they're spraying
the
milk like super soakers, and he's just laughing his head off, and I'm just like, what the hell are you doing at this stage in the film?
You got cows fucking in one of them. A poor guy had loads of tarantulas all over his body. Yeah. I wouldn't have wanted to do that. Fuck that.
And
no way.
What's brilliant is that at this point, we're like maybe, 10 minutes towards the end of the film? And the film hasn't slowed down at any point. There is no wee break time. There is no time you can chat to somebody. There's no time to, like, you know, process. As I said, there's no time to process what's happening. You're 10 minutes towards the end, and it's just, here's some more high-powered crazy shit for you to try and process before we move on to the next one, which is already happening.
Yeah. So, I suppose just to sum up sort of my favourite individual shots of the film, because I guess there was one shot in... There's one of the stories... I said basically just reminded me of Mad Max.
Yeah.
Basically, it's about the guy, I think he's Uranus, I think, possibly.
He's the policeman, the head of the police,
yeah,
or something.
Yeah, the head of the police cuts young boys' testicles off, yeah, before they can go into battle. They have a battle of some sort, which is very, very weird. And at the end of that
scene... Again, that's with street protesters. That's with the counterculture people, yeah, who just get wiped out instantly.
Basically. And there's a shot right at the end of that sequence where there's all this smoke that billows across all the, mm-hmm, people. In like, it's like he's controlled this, yeah, smoke. It's a really awesome shot. It's, yeah, just amazing. I've got no idea how Hodorowski did that, but there's that. I say the scenes of the thief kind of walking up to the alchemist, mm-hmm, sort of in the rainbow colored.
That's very
stuff.
Good.
That's all.
That's
awesome.
Very, very good. Yeah.
And yeah, the scene with the thief when he's basically Jesus and he's surrounded by all these effigies of him, and then he goes, yeah, into, and there's just so many of them as well. Just the way that was done. Was
there's
just
a lot in this
awesome
film, as you've already said, but I'll say it again. There's so many things where, like, wow, they had to make all those Jesuses,
yeah,
for that one shot. And then they're all destroyed because they show them all destroyed. So, like, so imagine being the props guy in this film. And every day you're just given a list of crazy crap. And you're just like, for goodness sake.
Crazy crap. Love it. So, yeah, so a shout out really must go out to the cinematographer on this film, because, mm-hmm, it's absolutely wonderful and amazing. It's Raphael Korkidi, who was also the cinematographer on El Topo.
Well, so not surprised. Yeah,
so obviously
good partnership.
Hodorowski using the same kind of cinematographer two films in a row. It's really cool. There isn't really a lot more really we can say about that, because with a film like this, it's very, very difficult to kind of talk about.
I have a question.
Incidents.
I have a question for you.
Oh, go on.
Okay, and there's no right or wrong answer here. So right at the end,
right
at the film, when a big spoiler alert again. I know I've already said this, but when he goes, you know, spiritual quest, etc., etc., you know what, reality's not even real, this is all a film, camera draw back, and it's like, right, now we can start the real spiritual quest. Mm. So do you think, and this isn't that, basically he's saying at that point, this whole film has been a big trick, you know, like I've been saying this whole time, I've been saying he's trolling the audience or he's taking the piss at that end bit when he goes, okay, this is all just a movie, camera pull back, everything up until now has been just, you know, don't buy into all the smoke and mirrors of spiritualism. Spiritualism is an individual quest, you know, do your own thing. Because that's basically what I think he's saying at the end of that film. But what do you think?
Well, I mean, again, I'm no good at this kind of stuff, so I'm just warning you now.
Yeah.
But I mean, to me, it could be seen as something... I don't know if this came out afterwards, mm-hmm, or around the same time, but like Monty Python and the Holy Grail, like the ending of that film,
yeah,
where it kind of tells you, right, you're in a film.
Yeah.
It's like, I know you've been watching a film, but now it's like breaking the fourth wall and, mm-hmm, telling you, right, you're in a film. I think it might be that the whole film is like a metaphorical version of like the artistic process in some way. Like you're creating these... I'm probably talking absolute bollocks.
No, go on,
so
go
I apologize
on.
In advance. But like, the whole film is like, you're creating these fantasies for people on screen, and it's all an illusion when you watch it. And we've shown you all these things, all these wonderful, wonderful things. But now you have to leave the cinema and go out into reality and face that, because that's the real world. And this is just like I say, it's a fake world, yeah, in a movie. I don't know. That's kind of something along those lines.
No, that's probably better than I put it.
Okay. If I was waffling like an absolute motherfucker.
Because another way I kind of look at it, or the way I combine different ways, because I've tried to come up with different ways of understanding this film, is that I feel almost like he, as somebody, as the documentary about him talking about tarot cards and stuff has shown,
yeah,
he's clearly a man who's looked at many different spiritualities and many, many different paths to achieving enlightenment. And I feel like he's almost going through the film as a checklist of like, look, I tried this, I tried this, I tried this, I tried this. And in the end, when, you know, when they finally get to the top of the mountain, and there's the nine immortals, and it turns out that they're all fake as well.
Yeah.
I think, and then he goes, right, now you have to do your own thing. I feel that that's him saying, look, I've tried lots of different things, and most of it's going to be crap. Most of it is going to lead to nowhere. Most of it's going to lead to the Pantheon Bar.
Yeah.
But that's not to say that spiritualism is nonsense. There is something out there for you, but you have to do it on your own. That's something you could take from it.
Or, you know, another thing I just thought of, maybe, again, this could be complete bollocks, but obviously it's his film. He's a director. Mm-hmm. He's playing this character who's the alchemist.
Yeah.
He's kind of showing them the way. So maybe the alchemist is just a version of him.
Oh, definitely.
In a way. That's a very obvious way of reading it or whatever. But again, that could be something in it.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are many millions of other kind of interpretations out there of people who are far, far, far better at sort of this kind of thing than I am. Certainly anyway. At least I feel that way. So it's the time of the show where I'm going to ask you to rate this film out of 5. So in terms of kind of your enjoyment of the film, kind of what would you score this?
I would score this as a 4 out of 5. I think potentially there could be room for improvement, just tidying up a few maybe loose ends. Maybe be better off not doing that. If it was too tidy, I think it would lose some of its appeal. But I certainly feel because there's so much in there, it's just a little bit exhausting, hence not a full 5 out of 5, but a very, very high 4.9 out of 5. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I probably would give this a 5. I mean, in terms of surrealism, I think it's very, very difficult to kind of top this film. I've seen Santa Sangre and El Topo, sort of his two other main films. And I'd say of the three, including this one is probably my favourite, although I do like all three of them.
Yeah,
I think they're all awesome in their own way. I just think with this one, it's just so visually pleasing and it's just, there's just so much there to, like I said earlier, if you were not necessarily someone who had ever really seen a surreal experimental film before, this is a really good entry point for that because you've got all this stuff, but it is tied to an actual story and the story doesn't, even though, well, I say it's not really a properly, you know, free act structure with like characters and character motivations and all that kind of shit. There is still a story attached to it that you can follow as such, even if the first 30 minutes is quite overwhelming, as I said. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the interesting question because we come to the, is it a good date movie or a bad date movie? So from 1 to 5, how would you rate this as a date movie?
I would rate this probably as a very high 3.
Okay.
And my reason for that is, I reckon this is definitely a film you can discuss afterwards.
Like, yeah, I agree.
Just almost going back to one of your other points, but very much to do, is it a good date movie or not? Even if you don't understand it. We're sitting here pretending we know what we're talking about. God knows what this film's really about.
Exactly.
But it's just, that's what makes it juicy. You don't have to be knowledgeable about surrealism or Eastern philosophy to get to enjoy this film. It's a real feast for the eyes. I think it's a very enjoyable film. And I think on a date, depending on who you're dating, I reckon it could go either way. They could either walk away going, this guy's nuts, or this guy's pretentious for putting this on. This film's really fucking interesting. What's going on here? What's that about? You know, it's definitely something that, I would maybe, I know we can't, I'm not going to do a 3.5. So I'll stick with...
Halves aren't allowed, I'm afraid.
I'll stick with 3.
Okay. I would say this is probably a 2 out of 5. So I wouldn't say this is a flat out, like, oh, you know, just Netflix and chill, you know. Although, to be honest, this might actually work as a Netflix and chill movie. Because it's so weird and there's so much going on, there is a possibility that the person you're with, if they are likely to, you know, lose attention halfway through, they could just get bored, possibly, because there's so much going on and it's so overwhelming. Yeah. If you're not in the right frame of mind, this could lose people quite heavily. So you might be onto a winner with this one, but it could also have the opposite effect as well, where, because it's so weird, they might just think you're, you know, really pretentious, or they might just think you're, you know, on drugs. You know, you're high as a kite or whatever. But it's certainly not offensive.
I think people would enjoy this film.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's a very enjoyable film to watch. Mm. And that's what gives me it sort of... That's what stops me from saying it's a bad date movie. I think you can... That's why it has the potential to be just like the person. Even if they just end up laughing all the way through. That's a good thing on a date, right? You know, it's...
Well, yeah, exactly. They wouldn't not enjoy themselves. There's certainly films out there that we're going to talk about on this show where by the end of it, they're just going to feel horrendously terrible.
Mm.
I mean, fuck, we did Cannibal Holocaust last time you were on the show.
Yeah, Jesus.
So you'd certainly feel better watching this than you would do watching Cannibal Holocaust. Mm-hmm. That's for damn sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, basically it might work as a date movie or it might not. You kind of have to gauge your audience,
mm-hmm.
I think is the short answer of this one. Cool. So if you like the sound of this film, got to be honest, it won't be to everyone's taste. And that's fine because everybody's right and everybody's wrong after all. So if you like the sound of this and you want to buy it on DVD, the version I own is from Tartan Films because we're in the UK, in the mean streets of South Croydon. Now, on DVDcompare.com, which is where I get a lot of this information from, it says that DVD is region 2. However, the version that I have says it's region 0.
Mm-hmm.
So if it is, in fact, region 0, then it doesn't matter where in the world it is. You can buy it from the Tartan version. If you're in America, region 1, you can buy it from Anchor Bay on both DVD and Blu-ray. Should say that the Tartan version is DVD only.
Mm-hmm.
Not actually available on Blu-ray at the moment in the UK, which is a bit surprising.
Very surprising.
Someone needs to get on that kind of right away.
Give Arrow a chance.
Yeah.
But they'll be on that like a shot.
I'm sure Arrow will. Yeah, sort of thing they would do. If you're in this region and you want to buy it on Blu-ray, apparently the best version to buy is from Alive, which I'm not quite sure what country that is. That might be Austria or Germany or one of those kind of countries.
It's going to be one of those dodgy, knocking around eBay kind of.
apparently, that's the best version, according to DVD Compare, if you want to buy it on Blu-ray currently, and you're in the UK. Right, so thank you once again to Mr. Tom Dennett-Cook.
Thank you so much.
Show.
That was really fun to watch.
It was,
I'm glad we did that.
Yeah, I know, I am too. It's awesome. Obviously, I'm going to have you on the show at some point in the future.
Looking forward to it.
Looking forward to it. Unless I make you watch something really horrible, in which case you won't be looking forward to it.
No.
You have to wait and see on that one. As I said, if you've not done so already, if you enjoyed this show, please subscribe to wherever you listen to your podcasts and rate us 5 stars if you can, in fact, do so. If you have any movies that you think would qualify as a worst date movie that you want us to talk about on this show, please hit me up on Twitter at Worst Date Movies and let me know. And who knows, you know, if I think you've got a good idea, I may very well bring some unlucky victim on the show and we'll talk about it for your, you know, listening pleasure. Absolutely. So again, thank you very much, Tom Dennett-Cook.
You know what? I'm going to change my worst date thing to 2. I'm joining you on that.
Oh, wow.
It's really? You've sold me. It's definitely, I'd definitely give it a go.
Okay. Well, there you go. So we both think it's a pretty good date movie.
Yes.
You could probably do slightly better if you're with a more conventional person, but hey, you know, if they're a bit more adventurous, give this one a go, by
it's
all
a
means.
Good sign. If they like it, that person's a keeper.
Definitely. I definitely agree with that. And on that note, I'm going to leave you and I'll see you guys next time.